Okay, good morning, everyone. We're going to make a start. So, a special welcome to our people who are joining us online, who, if you have a look over on the back wall, you'll be able to see as well. So, this is all new and interesting for us.
Okay.
Yes. Zoomies. Morning, Zoomies. Okay, we're going to start with a song, and as you probably all know, there's no singing allowed. But I, yes, boo for no singing, but I really liked it on our Zoom meetings when there was instrumental and I could kind of sing inside my own head or, well, yes, you could also hum. So anyway, be creative. Think about how do you feel the music? Do you need to move? Do you need to sway? Do you need to hum or sing inside your head? Do you need to focus on our wonderful and accomplished instrumentalists? So don't be shy. Pretend that you're still in the privacy of your own home and let the music be a part of you. Thanks for getting dressed, everybody, this morning. Let the music be a part of you. Allow it to enter your being and be a prayer to the Lord our God. So let's start.
We're all going to be a bit weird with the music.
My personal favourite is to think, is to imagine all of our voices together and remember when we have done that in the past, and I know that we will again. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, the Whadjuk Noongar people, and recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their cultures, and to elders both past and present. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. It's so very nice to see you all here today. And I'd really like to take a moment just to drink this in. There's a really big mix of feelings for me right now, and I suspect that I'm not alone in that. I'm really, really happy to be here, and alongside that happiness is lots of other feelings. These are just the ones that came to me, you know, within a minute when I sat down to think about this last night. I'm sure if I thought some more, there'd be lots more that I could come up with as well. Anyone else feeling like that? Lots of different things all at once. Yeah. There's lots to be happy about. There's lots to be grateful for. There's also lots to be sad about, lots to be angry about and confused and all kinds of other things. The operative word for me here is and. All of these things, they're all a part of me, and my job is to try and hold them lightly and to listen to God amidst that and within that. Just going to play you a short song in a sec. It's by Sarah Groves, who Gary recommended, who he thought that we might enjoy. And he suggested this song called Second Guess Girl that I actually thought touched on that sense of this and that and this and that. So enjoy.
The time for speech or the silence, you calling for peace or defiance, the spark in the council of wisdom, we all perpetrators of things. The spotlight temporal history, to complex decipher in mystery. Blessing or ill-gotten wealth, must be in the God of myself. It's a hard world for a second-guess girl.
Typical MHCC style, I sent out an email saying, hey, we're getting together. How do you want to, what do you want it to look like? What should we do? And a big gold star to Nona, who is the only person who replied to that message. So well done, Nona, who's the only person who didn't trust me to just come up with something. And what Nona suggested was, I'm sure, something that we'd all appreciate as well, which is just about spending time together and catching up. And I can't remember if you said music. Did you say music as well?
I was more about just spending a lot of time just talking to
you. Yeah. So in a minute, we're going to have just a little bit of a kind of catch up, like a passing the peace type thing. And I just wondered, does anyone have any creative ways of greeting people when you're not allowed to touch? Because I don't know about you, but the whole, like, let's touch feet or something, just don't feel the love from that. One of my friends does like a virtual hug where she kind of says, you know, yeah. Has anyone else come across anything good that actually, you know, feels nice? No, that's a bit sad. Yeah, I like that.
So namaste means I salute the God within you. I recognise the divine within you in the Pali Hindu Sanskrit culture. And I love that as a way of greeting, and that's quite COVID safe. So while I'm here, greetings, namaste to you all.
So up on the screen, I've just got some suggestions to get you thinking about what has been happening for you and how have you been and that sort of thing. You don't have to stick to the script. It was just some ideas. And I've asked a couple of people to share with us all at the end. And if anyone else would like to do that, you are welcome to as well. So we'll just spend about 5 minutes now if you want to say hello. And yeah. Plenty more opportunities to catch up after the service. I would like to invite Julie just to share with us for a minute or two on what she's been up to and how she's been.
Okay, yes. Well, very good to see you all. Thank you. Yes, big kind of sigh of relief, really, to get out of the house for Zoom and not have my neighbours on the doorstep at the same time. I guess I've been thankful for some time of sort of not having to rush around, but it's also kind of been a bit nerve-wracking in some ways because things with my neighbours calling the ambulance and fellow next door on drugs and so on. It's I've been thankful for, you know, my good neighbours, good friends, and family. And I've been looking through some old papers and photos and things which have been kind of like important to me to rediscover those, and I'm thinking of writing my story, but I felt like it's been a kind of coming together for me in some ways to be able to do that, and at the same time it's wonderful to be here again and see you all. So I thank you. Yeah, I had some good talks with people, my neighbours and friends, which have been very important as well. So I feel like God has been with me during this time to give me the right words to say and to be in the right place at the right time. So that's been a blessing as well. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, I'm first of all just enjoy seeing everybody. It is really nice to see everybody in person and all together. It has been good being able to see people on Zoom, but it's nice to be here. I actually haven't found it particularly tough. I feel very privileged. I guess the introvert in me quite enjoys staying home. I have enjoyed the more flexible time frame that we've been living in, not running to the clock all the time, although I think it's established a few bad habits in being pretty slack about things, and I found it quite a challenge to be here on time this morning. I've been working and I've actually been very busy. Work-wise, things haven't changed very much except that I've just been working from home because I teach a diabetes course online. And I think everybody out there has been bored and looking for something online, so their enrolments have skyrocketed and the enrolled students have decided that they're going to really get in and do the course thoroughly and have been quite active. So I've spent a lot of time communicating with people all over the world. It's quite amazing. In Europe, in Russia, in Africa, Asia, all over the place. It seems particularly the Middle Eastern countries, people have been very interested in the diabetes course. So that really has taken up a lot of time, but I find it most enjoyable, even a bit challenging at times. As I say, I don't mind having to stay home, although Bevan has found it a little harder to stay home and he seems to have found an excuse to be out and about almost every day for some reason. The things I've learnt, I guess the part of it is slowing down and not rushing around. The other side of things, though, although I feel privileged to be financially secure, have an interesting job to do, feeling safe in my home, I'm very much aware from the news that there are a lot of people out there who are suffering, people who've lost their jobs, people who are feeling lonely and isolated, people who are anxious, people who are sick, people who are bereaved, and not only in our own country, but I'm horrified at what I'm seeing in other countries, and I'm feeling quite apprehensive about what this is all coming to in places like America and Mexico and various other places that have been really badly hit. So for me, there's a duality. I feel very privileged and comfortable myself, but very apprehensive for all the people who are so badly affected. And I wonder, I say to God, where's all this going? So I'm sort of hanging there and at the same time thinking, well, what do I do about it? Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Julie and Trish. Is there anyone else who'd like to share with us briefly about what's been happening?
I'd like to say something if I have time. I was looking forward to coming this morning and I did regret the fact that I've got a bad case of giardia. But I deeply regret not being there with you people this morning because you're so much part of my life. Thank you.
Thanks, Bevan. It's really nice to hear from you. I'm sorry that you're not well.
I think it's time for a formal thank you to Greg, Tyson, Ian, Scott, everybody who's made this Zoomy stuff work really, really well. It's been fabulous and the sense of connection has been worth its weight in gold. So thank you, thank you. And anyone else I forgot in all of that, Lee and whomever else does it, but it really is fabulous. And nothing will leave me in so much hilarity as Jen and Luke in bed every Sunday.
It's a different sort of church, isn't it? I go to a church where we all just hang out in bed. So I've ticked everyone in as they've arrived this morning, but if you could just look at the sheet and make sure I haven't missed you. We do have to record who's attended. I've done you, John, you're fine. But just the sheets with the hand sanitizer, just check that you are ticked in case I've forgotten someone.
Heavenly Father, there's so much for us to be thankful for, so much for us to take joy in. And there's also a lot of pain and a lot of suffering, both in our own lives, in the lives of those who we love and know and care about, and also in our world. We think of those dealing with COVID and those dealing with racism and sexism. We think of those dealing with illness. Each and every one of them, your child. And there are no words. Amen. And now I'd really like to do a children's story. So, I'm sure we can do a physically distant children's story. That should be fine.
So, you guys are pretty clued up, right? Like, you pay attention, I know you do. And so, I don't know if you've heard me talking about this idea of being happy and sad at the same time. There's lots of good stuff and there's also lots of bad stuff. There's things that are good, things that are hard, things that are easy. And when I was thinking about that, happy sadness is one of my favourite expressions. And so I thought of all the stories to read this morning, I think it needs to be this one that's called The Big Little Book of Happy Sadness. So there are at least two children here who know the story well, am I right? Yeah, okay. Eden and Eva, this came from your house. Do you know this one well? Not very well? Excellent. Okay. Right.
I like it.
Okay. George lived alone with his grandmother and an empty place where his mother and father should have been. George's grandmother was a kind lady, but she was very old, and the two of them spent most of their lives on different planets. Most Friday afternoons on his way home from school, in that time before the weekend when lonely people realised just how lonely they are, George visited the dog shelter, and he always seemed to end up by the last cage in the last aisle. Even the concrete had given up down there. Hidden in the shade of a huge tree where the sun never bothered to go, the concrete and the cages sat beneath a coat of verdigris. What's verdigris? Anyone? Is it that plant thingy? Oh, okay. The last cage was where the dogs no one wanted went for a final week before their journey to heaven. George felt at home there. I wonder why he felt home there. In the dark gloom, he found a place where everything seemed lonelier than he was. Notice what your feelings do as you listen to this story. The last cage was often empty, and any dog that did find itself in there usually hid in the shadows, unseen and unloved, until one special Friday, George arrived and found a dog sitting at the front of the cage looking at him. George stared at the dog, and the dog stared at George, and they both knew they were seeing a reflection of themselves. Does that look like George? No. I wonder what that means then. Oh, this one. Does that look like George? No, it still doesn't look like him. I wonder what that's about. The dog, like George, was scruffy and sad, yet even at the end of the line, he was quietly dignified and seemed to accept his fate. Here was a dog George could really identify with. "The last dog," said George to the lady in the office. "Last dog?" "Yes, the one down the end," said George. "Oh, yes, poor thing. It's his final day today," she said. "Can I take him?" "We are talking about the same dog, are we?" she asked. "The three-legged one in the last cage?" George nodded. "Why would you want him? We've got 87 other dogs here. They've all got four legs and bright eyes and a coat that doesn't look like it's covered in lard," said the woman. "Why not take one of them?" No, I want the last dog, said George. He's called Jeremy, said the woman, and you'll have to ask your parents first. We close in 1 hour. George ran home faster than he had ever run before, so fast that all the air and words were sucked out of him. Dog, dog, Jeremy, was all he could manage. Slow down, said George's grandmother. No time, dog, said George. We'll have to think about this, said the old lady. It is a big decision. You know what they say, a dog isn't just for Christmas, it's for life. But he won't have a life tomorrow, said George, and finally managed to tell her about Jeremy. His grandmother saw the big empty place inside George and got her coat. You go on ahead, she said, I'll catch up. George ran back and caught the office lady who was getting ready to leave. They waited for George's grandmother together. In his cage, Jeremy waited too. Curled up in his basket, he watched the sky grow dark and closed his eyes. And then his cage opened for the last time. But it's not morning yet, thought Jeremy. I didn't even get my last dream. There was the little round boy who had looked at him before and an old lady. They were both smiling at him and they didn't take him towards the green door that led to the big kennel in the sky. They turned left and went back to the office. The dog shelter lady gave Jeremy a bright blue collar and a lead and a disc with his name on it. They were the first ones he had ever owned because no one had wanted to take him for a walk before. People don't when you've only got three legs. A walk isn't so much a walk as a hobble followed by a falling over, a getting up and then doing it all over again. Have you seen three-legged dogs before? They're actually pretty clever, the way they adapt. After it had taken 5 minutes just to reach the shelter's gate, George picked Jeremy up and carried him home. Jeremy had never been indoors before. When George lifted him onto an armchair in front of the fire, Jeremy thought that maybe he had gone through the green door after all and died and gone to heaven. In the next few weeks, Jeremy learned a whole new vocabulary full of words like cushion and dinner and cuddle. George's world was filled with words he had heard but never experienced before, like warmth and not being on your own. The one word they both wanted to add was walkies, but they needed one more leg for that. So George and his grandmother decided to do something about it. They would make Jeremy a leg. Neither of them were very good at making things, so they started modestly. They mixed up flour and water paste and built a leg out of newspaper. They included the new TV guide, even though it was only Tuesday, which just goes to show how much they loved Jeremy. It's one of the great faults of nature that dogs can't smile. Because when Jeremy ran round the garden on his new leg, he had a grin inside his head as wide as Australia. He ran over the tree and, for the first time in his life, lifted his leg. Of course, only having three legs, he could have done the same thing without having to lift one. But he always got muddled up, lifted the wrong leg, and ended up flat on his face with a wet tummy. Not anymore. But then his new leg got wet and collapsed. So George's grandmother baked Jeremy a pastry leg. But have a guess what happened. Jeremy kept eating it. Finally, George sharpened his penknife and carved Jeremy a wooden leg like pirates wear. Then he made a second leg with a wheel on the bottom so they could play football in the park, and a third leg with a slipper on the end for bedtime. The empty place inside George didn't seem so empty anymore, and the three of them lived happily ever after for a very long time. I love that story.
So we're going to not sing again together, Prince of Peace, and then I'll hand over to Elise to speak with us.
About 15 minutes ago I'd left my glasses at home, so potentially you're going to see a lot of this, but we'll see how I go. I think I'll be all right. I forget my glasses because I don't wear them all the time, but I'm finding I have less capacity to go without them as I get older. Good morning. I acknowledge I stand on Noongar Whadjuk land and that I recognise the wisdom and the fortitude of elders past and present as custodians of the land and leaders of their people. I'm talking about my work today, so I also wish to acknowledge the harm done by my profession. My profession has hurt First Nations people, sometimes by acts of aggression and sometimes by acts of omission. The knowledge base from which I work, that I use in my day-to-day profession, is tainted. My hope is with wisdom our profession can seek to join First Nations people and find a new path. Good morning. It's lovely to see you all and to hear you and to smell you and to know that we are more than the sum of our parts. Good morning to our Zoomies. I don't know what to do with you, but hi. I know, no, they're there. They're there and there. Anyway. As I said, today I'm talking about my work, and I'm doing this because I was chatting to Greg about a work thing a couple of months ago, and something I said prompted him to say, you should talk about this at church. I don't know what we were talking about. Sometime later, Claire asked me to speak. So here I am. It's been difficult for me to work out what I want to say. Someone commented to me this morning, I can't wait to find out what the mystery is of your speech. And I was like, oh, didn't mean it to be a mystery. I didn't know what I was going to say. Poor old Alyssa didn't even know what my topic was, and she was leading the service. So here I am. It's been difficult for me. Something about finding God in the mundane of the day-to-day, and something about expressing my faith through my life. I fear boring you with my day-to-day life. I fear sounding arrogant or self-aggrandizing. I fear being judged for my clinical practice. Since I believe there is only love and fear, I share my fear with you and ask that you love me. Take what I offer lightly. Know I have no extra wisdom. I don't come stand here to teach, but to share. I'm also quite emotional today, just being back. So there's nothing particularly hard or sad in what I'm going to say. More than usual is life, but I'm just going to burst into tears intermittently, and it's nothing, not a thing. So my work. I work in the disability sector. I'm going to talk about my employers as the association. I'm a clinical psychologist delivering therapy to clients and their families. I'm a team leader. I'm a team leader for a host of clinical staff. I'm a consultant psychologist for a wider team of clinical staff. My role is quite diverse in terms of what I do on any given day. The association has not always been a comfortable fit for me, although I've found my home there now. I love my work. I'm learning all the time, and I get to bring my clinical knowledge and skills to bear, my experience, both lived and work-based. I'm fortunate to have had quite a diverse work experience up till now. I was reflecting to Claire, I worked in a program that was established under Premier and Cabinet, which made it hugely political and very unpopular with the wider government departments and bureaucrats. And in the first 2 years, in the first 2 years, they invested a lot in training. The program itself was disbanded, the politics happened, and nothing ever really came of being in that program. There was never a product, which is kind of disheartening when you consider the amount of money that were put into it. But there was an outcome in that you had this team of people who were trained in a way that wasn't often done in the public service. We got access to some really broad and deep training. So I get to bring all of that stuff now with me. And the goal is to improve the quality of life to a wide range of people. And I'm not perfect, and I don't succeed in all my endeavours. I'm actually not going to tell you all the nitty-gritty of my work. My clients are entitled to their privacy, and frankly, you're entitled to something a bit more interesting. But I will give you a bit of context to understand the picture of my work. My clients range in age from early childhood through to older adult. In order to have me involved, they present with some sort of behaviour that others find difficult. What that behaviour is tends to depend on who the other is. Everything from not doing their homework, to biting and hitting to communicate, to having preferences that are illegal, or refusing to leave the house. There is great variety in what my work brings me. I'm really privileged to work with an excellent team. I'm one of three team leaders in our small team of OTs and psychs. We trust each other and we communicate easily and with confidence that we'll back each other up. I like to think that we're reflective and care about the other people we provide services to. There's always more work to be done than people to do the work. We sit in amongst a much larger team of clinicians who support individuals and families in the general day-to-day autism interventions. this team, it works in schools, in homes, in workplaces, in respite services, in community access. They are speech pathologists and OTs, and they're majority new grads. They care about the people who they work with. The difficulty for me, and where I've always felt quite uncomfortable with the association as a wider organisation, was established, is that it was established by a group of parents seeking to provide services for their children. Sounds right. That's how things should be. It's still largely led by this cohort. The board is largely made up of parents. They are white, majority male. They are accountants and doctors and IT professionals. They share their time and their lived experience, and they have created a world-leading evidence-based autism service for people who look like them. This is often where I find myself rubbing against the corners of my work. The culture of the association is that we provide an autism service. We only deal with the autism, and if there are issues, there are other issues, then we refer out. And I actually don't disagree with this. You can't be everything to everyone. I'm a big proponent, though, of having more people in the boat. And that's a direct quote from one of my colleagues. We need more people in the boat. But we have to stay in the boat, even if it's damp and uncomfortable and at the risk of capsizing at times. The association has tended to exit stage right and get on board the 30-foot yacht across the bay. I need to be clear here. I am exaggerating, and I'm not really being fair. There are people at the association who stay in the boat and they bail like hell. But the defining culture and the policies of the organisation have been to work on the autism. And if there's factors that stop that work from being successful, then we just throw up our hands in despair and look over there. We don't train our staff in how to be culturally sensitive. We don't talk about the role of trauma in decision making. We don't talk about the integration of trauma in historical harm. We don't even talk about the bad old days of autism intervention that harmed people. In fact, some of the people that we still work with were harmed in that era. It's not that long ago. We won't train our staff in how to support someone who's in great distress and harming themselves right now. If someone's suicidal, we refer out and step back. Many classroom teachers get more training in how to assess and respond to suicidality than our clinicians. So I rub against the corners of this a bit. I talk about how we can provide an autism service in the context of all that other stuff that happens in people's lives, because you can't actually take the autism out of it. I talk about how harmful it would be for us to exit in individual cases. I suggest we train our staff in something more than the basics of autism intervention. I provide clinical guidance to staff who want to do more than throw their hands up. And I need to be clear here, I'm not alone. I don't want to portray myself as some holy warrior fighting the tyranny of oppression. I'm a voice, and being this voice is where I find my expression of my faith. It's where I am the hands and feet of Christ. I'm fortunate now to find myself in a chorus of voices. My team recognises the limits of only dealing with the autism. As a team, we share similar values and we are providing a broader service and we're upskilling the staff around us. This started before I came along. Under the old funding model, we had the flexibility to work out who got what funding. So if people needed a bit of extra time from their key therapist, we stole from Peter and paid Paul. Then the NDIS came along. The NDIS is an excellent, wonderful, stupendous outcome for many families. If you are someone who's able to turn up to a meeting, sit in a room and articulate what your day-to-day life is like, who can talk about what's hard for you and your family, my experience is that you will get the funding you need. If you're someone who can engage and tolerate a therapeutic service, who can identify and articulate your deficits, your disability, you're great. You get an even greater funding package. Once you get your funding, if you live in the metro area and in stable housing and engage well with school or community or work, your therapy and your support services can help you achieve the goals that mean in the future you will need less support. This is the model of NDIS therapy. Put funding in now to give reasonable and necessary supports so that less funding is needed later. You have choice and control in how you engage in your therapy. What could be better? I don't want to fall down a rabbit hole of explaining the ins and outs of NDIS. But suffice to say, there is a segment of population who do not fit this criteria. It is hard to provide services to these clients. And with the withdrawal of the old funding model, there is absolutely no opportunity to rob Peter to pay Paul unless you want to commit actual fraud and risk going to jail. There are NDIS planners out there who get it, and they make sure clients get the right funding so that providers have the right time to do what needs to be done. I have a client at the moment who has the most astonishing funding package and who DSC frankly failed. So it is working in some circumstances, but it definitely depends on the planner having the skills to know what's needed, and there's definitely planners out there who need upskilling. There is also this ongoing, grinding conversation about what is reasonable and necessary. I am aware of a planning meeting in which a woman was told that it was reasonable and necessary for her to stop work so that she could be available to care for her school-aged child, since they were not able to access appropriate after-school care. What is reasonable and necessary seems to depend on the circumstances of what your genitalia looks like. In the last 12 months, I've actually written something like this sentence. It is not reasonable and necessary for a woman to be entirely dependent on her husband in order to understand her own financial situation. It's 2020. Yeah, I really did have to write that down. I had to say that out loud. So I want to stop here and acknowledge some of the lived experience in this room. There are people in this room who have left work in order to care for their child with a disability. There are people who have made choices in their life that meant they could give their child the best opportunity. This is a valid choice, but it must be a choice. A just and caring society must provide for the least of these. All must be given the same opportunity to work, to participate in recreation, to fail and to take risks. I don't think I'm telling anyone anything new when I say we're still on that journey, but NDIS promised much. We must work to hold it to its promise. The promise of needs-based funding in the NDIS model is important and necessary, but it's all about the individual. One of the overriding concerns I have about NDIS is that it's only about the individual. There is no opportunity for the community to participate in the conversation. The autism community is awesome. They are loud, they are aggressive, they have strong opinions, they don't agree. They want to be heard and they want to participate. If any funded service wants to join in with that conversation, if they want to share that community's fight, if they want to facilitate participation, they have to do so outside the NDIS funding model. They have to care enough to source funding other ways or to provide services, because NDIS is all about the individual and their needs. There is no room for community. So what does this all have to do with God? First of all, my job's really demanding. I'm constantly actively having to engage in activities of self-care. I'm not very good at doing this. I work on my days off. I think about my clients. Don't laugh at me, Greg. I work on my days off. I think about my clients when I'm at home. I don't do exercise every day, even though I know it's one of the most productive self-care activities I can undertake. So I go through these cycles of success and failure, ups and downs, stress and distress, coping and definitely not coping. I have good days and I have really bad days where I come home and I pull the doona. I literally come home and go to bed and read my book. And yeah, God accepts and knows all my successes and all of my failures, both in the work I do and in my work of self-care. I'm very blessed to have a very patient and caring husband who sees me in my work. He knows its cost and he unfailingly steps in to fill the breach. Each and every time I fail to care for myself, and thus I am no longer able to care for my family. I believed I am blessed to have this man beside me. God is my safe harbour, and I return to it again and again, and I recharge and I go. When I'm in the middle of my work, I do not see God in the same way as when I stop and reflect, which makes stopping and reflecting so important, because otherwise I'm doing everything through my own strength and it's all about me. I know God is there and I don't doubt my faith and knowledge of God drive my hand, but I don't think of God or faith in the middle of what I do. I'm too much of a clinical psychologist. The stuff that I've talked about today, the advocacy for those who are not seen or not given enough, can only happen when I'm okay. It kind of sits on top of my role or my identity. It requires extra energy to fight against a culture, to fight against a system. During Reconciliation Week, the association made no acknowledgement of the week. I had a grand plan to send at least an email to our therapy staff with some education and resources that they could access if they chose. Then I got sick and I ran out of energy and I didn't do it. Just keeping on top of the needs of my clients and the staff I directly support was all I could manage, so I failed again. So you are all a part of this. You are part of God's safe harbour for me. My team at work are a part of it as well, and my family are a part of it. I'm privileged to come, I'm part of a matriarchy. Like, the women in my family are pretty awesome. and so they hold me when I can't do it. So that's what I wanted to say today. I didn't know what else I wanted to say. So that's where I'm going to leave it. But I guess I'd ask that you pray for me and that you put up with me when I don't necessarily do all the things that I've promised I would do. Thanks.
I just want to thank Elise for the work she does, but also give a little bit of perspective on what it's like from the other end. I've been lucky enough to have the Autism Association help me find a job. It's like me screwing it up by rampant substance abuse. I'm very grateful for the NDIS who have provided me with support to sort of do and have a wonderful OT as well who helped me navigate the process. And that's my experience, is that if you don't have someone to help you navigate the NDIS who is a professional, even a lot of the professionals don't know how to do it, then you're pretty stuffed. I have a friend over the road who has mild cerebral palsy and epilepsy, and she didn't get any funding, you know, so it's... Elise is totally right. The NDIS is good for some people, but you really need to know how to pull the strings. I'm also very fortunate to have somewhere to live because my mum pulled some strings with Homesware. So there's a lot to be grateful for, particularly to the Autism Association and people like Elise.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. And Thanks, Elise. That was really enriching. It's given me lots to think about and lots to challenge me. So we are going to finish with one of my favourite songs, which is A Blessing. Thank you. May the Lord bless and keep each and every one of you here and further afield. Amen.